Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. Give the active people in your life something they'll truly appreciate. Performance apparel from Vuori. Whether they're into running, surfing, hiking, or even just casual walks around the block, there's something for everyone. And if you're not sure what to gift them, you can't go wrong with something from Vuori's Dream Knit collection. It's the perfect gift and so comfortable. Get 20% off your first purchase today at Vuori, Vuori.com/Spotify.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The protests in Hong Kong are in their 10th week. Warnings from Beijing grow more ominous. Last week, an official there said the protesters are playing with fire and will perish by fire. Today, Beijing says the protests are beginning to look, quote, like terrorism. Anti-government protests began as a response to a harsh extradition law proposed by Beijing. Police have since fired tear gas at Hong Kong's protesters. And as China's response and rhetoric escalates, criticism and will from the protesters also grows. Now, all of this as relations between Washington and Beijing go from bad to worse, from trade dispute to trade war. And economists are worrying the world could be nudged into a global recession. So this hour, On Point, the latest from Hong Kong and the U.S.-China trade war. And you can join us. Do you have family in Hong Kong or mainland China? What are they telling you? What are your questions about the Hong Kong protests? What are your questions about the U.S.-China trade war? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will begin first today in Hong Kong with Natasha Khan. She's Hong Kong correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She's been on the streets today following the protests there. Natasha, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us about the latest about what's happening at Hong Kong's airport today.
Well, we had a pretty disruptive day in Hong Kong when the airport authority decided to cancel more than 100 flights through the evening, as thousands of protesters earlier in the day had swarmed the airport in response to what they say is police brutality yesterday.
And the police brutality being the tear gassing of protesters in a subway station?
Yes, there was tear gassing in subway stations. Particularly, one rallying point was one female protester who had been shot in the eye with a projectile. And so many protesters today at the airport were chanting an eye for an eye, you know, give us back the eye. And that has been a huge rallying point today.
So Hong Kong obviously is a hugely important city in Asia. What effect did the effective closure of the airport have on the city and on that on that part of Asia as well?
Right. Today it was particularly chaotic because of the sudden nature of the flight cancellations. I mean, the airport rally was really only called late last night after, the scenes emerged on how police and protesters had clashed on the streets. So, you know, it wasn't really very expected. And so when the flight cancellation were announced, it was a bit chaotic. I've heard of flights that were diverted to other cities and then, you know, had to turn back to where they had come from, and others who might have been trying to get home or trying to go for meetings that obviously couldn't get on their flight. In the more long term, officials here have been warning for the last few days in particular that ongoing protests will likely tip the economy here into a recession. And, you know, it's definitely the protests have also impacted sectors, in particular retail and tourism, quite hard.
Mm. Well, let's listen to part of a report today from Hong Kong's airport. This is from the Singaporean news service, Channel News Asia. As you said, the protest received a surge of energy and moved to the airport after that female protester had been badly injured over the weekend.
This is by far the biggest turnout in a peaceful sit-in at the airport. This after one of the female protesters had allegedly ruptured her right eye after being shot with a beanbag round during violent clashes at Tsim Sha Tsui overnight. These protesters' slogans here is today, police return an eye for an eye, they say.
That's a report from a Singaporean news service. Now, in a press conference today, the Chinese government, through a spokesperson, escalated its language using the word terrorism to describe the protesters. Here's a clip translated into English by China's state-owned CGTN.
Over the past few days, radical demonstrators in Hong Kong have repeatedly attacked the police with extremely dangerous tools, constituting serious violent crimes, and beginning to show signs of terrorism.
So, Natasha Khan, tell us about what China is signaling, what Beijing is signaling by using this escalated language.
I think that this escalated language is continuing their rhetoric in the last few days that they really would like the unrest here to stop. They've been putting more pressure through their words to the local government and, I guess, by association, the police force to really try to calm things down in the city. At the same time, a lot of people here, and especially in the protest camp, are also saying that this is a political problem and shouldn't really be solved with the police force. And so it's looking like this may continue for some time.
Well, so just as a reminder, these protests began in June in response to a pretty harsh extradition law that was proposed that would have had Hong Kong residents being extradited to mainland China for in certain cases. That law has been that proposal is no longer active.
The government has said it's suspended, and later the chief executive here, who's the leader of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, has said that the bill is dead, meaning that she said, you know, all legislative work on it has stopped. At the same time, perhaps to reflect the level of distrust of the government here, protesters, as one of their five demands that's been kept keeping them on the streets, have asked for a full withdrawal of the bill. And the government has kept stressing that they say this bill is dead and has not withdrawn it. So that's really what has started it. I think one of the things that sustained the movement, there's a few things. One of them, I guess, is also the fact that in the first day on June 9th, when an estimated 1 million people came out on the streets to protest this bill, quite shortly after the government sent a tersely worded press release that said, okay, well, you know, essentially, thank you so much for your feedback, but we're going to continue with the passage of this bill or the debate of this bill anyway, which really fired up emotions here. And I guess in the next ensuing few weeks, as we went through June, we saw quite a number of large protests that kept going on. Also in response, like today, to the way the police have responded to the protesters. And so that has really sustained the movement, which is why it seems that this injured woman and also, again, the scenes that emerged on the streets yesterday may also, again, inject a little bit more energy into the movement once again as we go, as you say, into the 10th week of protests here.
Mm. Now, there are, I mean, it seems as if beyond this extradition law, the protesters are also highly critical of other issues around Hong Kong governance, right? There's a stalled promise for direct elections. Is that right?
Yes. And in fact, if we've been, again, as we go into the 10th week, I think one of the things that's emerged is a lot of the anger and perhaps what's pushed some of the more radical protesters in the past few weeks has been really a lot of issues lie back in 2014 when there were a 79-day sit-in called the Umbrella Movement, where protesters basically slept on city streets to demand for democracy here in choosing the chief executive, actually. And that ultimately ended in December 2014, and the government didn't give any concessions and proceeded in the next few years to In effect, dismantle some of the pro-democracy camps. So, you know, you had, for example, a prominent voice here, Joshua Wong, who was sent to jail for a few months for his role in those protests. Or, you know, there were legislators that ran for government, and they were disqualified or not allowed to run in the first place. And so really what has emerged in the last few weeks has been that demand again for a fuller democratic and electoral reform here. Mm. And that's, again, one of the five demands I was mentioning before.
Well, let's get a quick call here. Keegan is calling from Paxton, Massachusetts. Keegan, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm in college right now, and just thinking back to my experience in my days in public education, and it seemed like I had a few teachers that just spoke in this sort of talking down, arrogant way, as if they are the first people to discover what they've been teaching. And I'm wondering why people at NPR sound just as condescending.
Well, Keegan, do you have a question about Hong Kong and the protests there? Okay, looks like Keegan is gone here. But Natasha, let me turn back to China using this heated or more escalated language, calling using the word terrorism, referencing the protesters here. We've got a comment on our website from NSTEF, who wonders if the use of the phrase "signs of terrorism" is Beijing indicating that it's preparing to use even more force. He says declaring it an act of terrorism justifies military intervention. Is that a possibility in Hong Kong?
I think that most people we've been talking to, we think that the possibility is really, really remote. I mean, if they do take that step, it really would be the end of the one country, two systems agreement that China has, and sort of how Hong Kong has this sort of autonomy that it enjoys now from China. At the same time, I'm not really sure that rhetoric really has that much impact on the protest camp themselves. So, you know, I've spoken to many of them who they just feel that it's more reason for them to be coming out, because, you know, part of this is also about rejecting the increasing influence of the mainland here in Hong Kong before they had promised.
Mm. So then ultimately, and we've got about 30 seconds to go here, Natasha, ultimately, what would bring these protests to an end? What would satisfy the protesters?
Well, a lot of people have been centering their demands on two main ones, which is an independent inquiry as to the police handling of the unrest in the last 10 weeks, and also, as mentioned earlier, the full withdrawal of the bill. I think that would take a lot of the heat out of the current movement, and that has been an ongoing request to the authorities here, though they've also signaled that they're not prepared to make those concessions.
Mm. Well, Natasha Khan, Hong Kong correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Hong Kong. Thank you very much, Natasha.
Thank you.
We are talking about the ongoing protests in Hong Kong and the escalation in the trade war between the United States and China. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Hong Kong protests and now also how they relate to the escalating trade war between the United States and China. And we're joined now by David Rennie. He's with us via Skype from Beijing. He's Beijing bureau chief and Chaguan columnist for The Economist. David Rennie, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So obviously the protests in Hong Kong are occupying the minds of the Beijing government, President Xi, most specifically, but as well as the escalating trade war between the United States and China. Are there links to draw? Is there a thread to draw between the two, David?
Certainly in terms of Chinese state media's propaganda, which has become this very, very heavy drumbeat in recent days, the message that the Chinese people are hearing, and remember the only message they can hear is from the state media, is that in fact the Hong Kong protests are the work of hidden foreign black hands. And by that they mean the Americans. And they've even been accusing kind of the CIA or various American diplomats of being behind this. And the overall story that they are telling the Chinese people is, why would America want to whip up protests in Hong Kong? Well, to the Chinese Communist Party, it's simple. America is used to being top dog. It's now getting old and tired and lazy and spoilt. China is working hard, catching up, may overtake America as the world's largest economy very soon. And a vindictive, aging America is lashing out and is playing dirty tricks, whipping up subversion in Hong Kong and dangerous radicals in order to hold China down. That is the overwhelming propaganda story that is being fed to the Chinese people right now. And it's almost, look, it's impossible even sitting here in Beijing to know what 1.4 billion Chinese people think. But at least on the bits of the social media where Chinese people are allowed to say what they think, which is itself heavily, heavily censored, there is a lot of anger about Hong Kong and a lot of people buying into that narrative that this is an American-led conspiracy.
Well, let's listen to a moment to exactly what you're referring to, because on Wednesday, a government spokesman in Beijing did indeed use that language in a press conference. And so we'll hear it translated by the Korean news channel Arirang News.
We would like to make a clear warning to the very small group of unscrupulous and violent criminals and the dirty forces behind them. Those who play with fire will perish by it.
So, David Rennie, that's fascinating to hear that the Chinese state media is drawing a connection between the two. Is there any evidence that what they're saying is true?
So it depends on your definition of subversion. I mean, what is the case is that the American government, some of its most senior leaders, up to Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, various senior members of Congress like the Speaker Nancy Pelosi, they have very openly been meeting pro-democracy leaders from Hong Kong because they see that as the kind of thing that America does. America is in favor of democracy. America is the shining city on the hill. And so they don't hide those activities. Those images of those meetings are being kind of edited together here in Beijing with images in some cases of just kind of random white people on the streets of Hong Kong saying, who can say who these mysterious foreigners are? Are they CIA? That's what we might have to ask. And so you can see the conspiracy theory is drawing on the stuff that America does all the time very openly and playing with the kind of conspiracy theory. Of course, the wrinkle in this is that I talked about Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo, but I didn't talk about Donald Trump, the president at the top of the system, because if your listeners remember, when he was asked about Hong Kong and these protests nearly 2 weeks ago now, he actually broke protesters' hearts in Hong Kong because he said it was for China to deal with, that these were riots that had been going on a long time, and that word is really loaded. The Chinese government calls them riots. The protesters say they're peaceful demonstrations. And so to them, they suddenly realized that maybe America's president was willing to trade away Hong Kong's democracy protests, perhaps for a concession in the trade war. And that really went down very badly in Hong Kong. Didn't really buy Donald Trump much goodwill here in America, because the kind of narrative here that you hear, not just in public in the state media, but also from Chinese officials to people like me or to diplomats, is that, well, maybe Donald Trump doesn't care so much about Hong Kong, but he is surrounded by very dangerous hawks determined to damage China, and maybe they will hijack Donald Trump and use Hong Kong to hurt China.
Mm. Well, David, let me take a couple of calls here on this point. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment. Jeffrey Epstein is still alive, and Pizzagate is...
Jerry, this is not... We're not doing Jeffrey Epstein this hour. We'll do it later in the week, but thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Joseph, who's calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on the air, and do you actually have a question about Beijing and Hong Kong and the United States?
Hi, Magna. Yes, I actually do. I was wondering whether or not these protests, given their democratic nature, are seen as a challenge directly to President Xi Jinping, or is that in the future?
All right. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for your call. So, David Rennie, let's tackle that head on. How does President Xi see these protests? Is it a direct challenge to him, especially since now that he is president for life?
So Joseph has put his finger on something absolutely fascinating, which is, of course, logically, this is a very direct challenge to President Xi and the entire Communist Party apparatus, because they run Hong Kong. They run it at arm's length. There is a Hong Kong government, but basically they offered Hong Kong a kind of a bargain, which was, if you don't challenge our political rule, if you don't really get involved in politics, and if you don't mind about not having elections, you can keep your freedom of speech. You can keep a free press much more than anyone in the mainland would have. And you can carry on doing what we think interests you in Hong Kong the most, which is making lots of money. And these protests for the last 10 weeks show that a really large number of people, some of these protests have had more than 1 million people out on the streets. And a lot of them are just regular folks, you know, parents with kids in strollers and grannies and, you know, not radical people at all. They do not want that bargain that Xi Jinping is offering, which is basically, you know, stay out of politics, forget democracy and get rich. What's really interesting is that when I was in Hong Kong last week, when you talk to protesters about exactly that, do you think that Xi Jinping would ever give you a concession? They say, well, we don't have a row with Xi Jinping. Our protest is with the Hong Kong government. They're just not protecting us, you know, from the mainland stuff we don't like. And so they're slightly, some of them, I think, in denial about the degree that they are confronting the central government, perhaps because that's just too terrifying a thought.
Mm. Well, on that note, David, you heard Natasha Khan a little earlier saying that Beijing doesn't necessarily want to escalate to the point of using military action on the Hong Kong protesters. Would you agree with that if indeed there is such a confrontation going on directly to President Xi?
Yeah, you have to assume that they understand that it would be catastrophic, at least in the short term, to have troops on the streets. That said, they do use the threat of troops on the streets because they're running out of threats, because no matter how much tear gas the police are firing, the protests still happen. So today, as the airport filled up for the third straight day with protesters and they closed the airport because they said the protesters were sort of disrupting flights, state media started releasing little video clips showing us armored personnel carriers of the paramilitary police force that answers to the military, the People's Armed Police, rolling round the mainland highways just across the border on the mainland side of the border and saying that they were conducting exercises. And some of those exercises they show you are riot control. And so they are absolutely showing that they are willing to roll over the border in armored personnel carriers and crack skulls if they have to. But you have to assume that self-interest is they don't want to do that. But they're also not about to give the Hong Kong people the concessions that the Hong Kong people are asking for, because the Communist Party doesn't lose. That's not how it works. And so that's why I think a lot of us here are extremely anxious about how this possibly kind of ends. Mm. We just don't see a good ending.
Well, let's go on this point. Let's go to James, who's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. James, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, James.
I have been told by a Chinese history professor before that China would never take hard action in Hong Kong because they want to show Taiwan that one country, two systems works. And I'm also wondering, how do these protests and the Chinese government's response affect politics and public opinion in Taiwan as they deal with issues of unity and division with the mainland?
James, thank you so much for that question. David, do you have a response for him?
Yeah, that's another excellent, excellent question. That is something we're talking about all the time here. Your caller is absolutely right that one country, two systems, that kind of handy catchphrase for this really high degree of autonomy that Hong Kong has, was actually coined as an offer to Taiwan back in the 80s by the then leader Deng Xiaoping. He then transferred it to Hong Kong when the British gave back Hong Kong as a kind of sign to Taiwan that this was the kind of deal that they could have. And for the longest time, optimists would tell you that because, exactly as your caller says, folk in Taiwan were supposed to look at Hong Kong and say, well, that seems to be working out not so badly. Maybe we could imagine rolling in and reunifying with China and becoming part of China as just a province of China. For the longest time, that gave optimists hope. The problem is that what is at stake in Hong Kong could well just be so large a humiliation for Xi Jinping to swallow that he is willing to take the hit. And the other problem that's going wrong is that, in fact, Taiwanese politics, you know, even the sort of the more pro-China politicians in Taiwan, and they're heading into an important election soon, they have looked at these images and they've said, well, we could never accept one country, two systems. It's not a generous enough offer for us. And so to some extent, Taiwan is drifting far enough away from that, that it no longer really holds its promise, which means it could be worryingly the case that actually they'll do what they want in Hong Kong and worry about Taiwan later.
Hmm. Well, we are talking this hour about the Hong Kong protests, and we will take a look at the escalating U.S. trade war between the United States and China and the effect that that may have or is having on the global economy. I'm joined today by David Rennie. He's Beijing bureau chief and Chagwan columnist for The Economist. And let's turn now to Robert Daly. He's joining us from Washington. He's director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center, former U.S. diplomat in Beijing, where he was an interpreter for Chinese and U.S. leaders as well. Robert Daly, welcome to you.
Good to be with you, Meghna.
So give us your take, your view on how Washington ought to be viewing these ongoing protests in Hong Kong.
Well, they need to take account of a fairly broad phenomenon that I think is worrying Beijing. It's not just in Hong Kong, where Beijing has had 22 years to convince the people that one country, two systems worked in their favor. And Beijing hasn't been able to close the deal. The protests make it very clear that even younger people who've grown up entirely within a school system that was broadly drifting more toward mainland ideas don't buy it. They're still interested in democracy. Other parts of China's periphery, Taiwan, which you just mentioned, they've had over 70 years there to convince the people of Taiwan that returning to the embrace of the motherland was in their interest, and it's going in the other direction. A lot of polling shows that Taiwanese increasingly don't identify as Chinese, but as Taiwanese. You also know that out in Xinjiang, where up to a million Uyghurs are in re-education camps, also where China has had 70 years to convince these people that they should be part of the motherland, it's not going well, and there are, you know, always issues coming up in Tibet. And so Xi Jinping has a very big to-do list, and while we are worried about him spreading his influence internationally, in fact, the Communist Party has trouble getting its influence accepted within its own borders and on its periphery. So Xi Jinping's leadership is not quite as stable and certain as is sometimes believed.
Okay, interesting. So a couple of minutes ago, David Rennie pointed out that perhaps Beijing might be seeing some of the language coming out of Washington, specifically from President Trump, as saying, you know, really what the most important thing is trade between the United States and China and the tensions there, more so than the Washington's formal view of what's happening in Hong Kong. Just what's your take on that and the messages that Washington is sending?
Well, I think it's clear that people within Beijing now, government leaders as well as the expert community, during the Trump administration have learned not to take any one promise or any one statement too seriously. They've experienced multiple instances of whiplash where they thought they had an agreement to, for example, not increase tariffs and to negotiate, and that has proven not to work out. So while it's true that President Trump so far has drawn a careful line between Hong Kong and the trade negotiations, I think that Beijing has seen enough of his method of transactional diplomacy now not to count on that over the long term. And they certainly hear the threats that come out of Congress to revisit the 1992, the Hong Kong Relations Act, under which the United States treats Hong Kong as a non-sovereign entity with which it has a separate trading relationship from that of China. So we don't, when we talk about our trade relationship with China, we don't include our exports to or imports from Hong Kong. That's accounted separately. And that has helped Beijing to make the claim that Hong Kong, in fact, does have a high degree of independence. That's now being reconsidered. So Beijing hears various signals from Washington, not just from Trump.
Okay. So David Rennie, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, no, Robert's absolutely right that that Beijing is aware and is kind of starting to learn the makeup of Congress versus some of the hawks. There's actually two sorts of hawks they're worried about. So you have President Trump, who essentially, they've realized that President Trump says incredibly alarming things to them, but they don't think he's actually really a China hawk. If China hawk means someone who fundamentally disapproves of the way that China does, say, human rights. You've very rarely heard President Trump say anything about Tibet or Taiwan's human rights or Xinjiang and the Uyghurs that Robert said are locked up there in very large numbers. So they know that President Trump is very focused on the trade war, and the Chinese read that as really about his electoral interests. You know, you talk to Chinese officials as they try and guess what President Trump means, and they'll talk about, you know, the farm states that want to sell soybeans to China and how President Trump has to win those in 2020 to get reelected. So for them, they have a very cynical view that President Trump is this transactional, exceedingly political, self-interested figure. They then know there are national security hawks who they have to worry about, and they get very upset by people like Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, on that kind of front. And then they're obsessed with the economic nationalists close to the president, people like, say, Peter Navarro, his very hawkish trade advisor, who they think wants to decouple the American economy from the Chinese economy and sort of break that kind of links of globalization between the two countries. And their terror, I think, is that the hawks will hijack President Trump and make him do hawkish things.
Mm. Well, David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist, speaking to us from Beijing, and Robert Daly in Washington, Director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. I'll ask you both to stand by here for just a moment, because we are talking about the Hong Kong protests, but now also about the escalating trade war between Washington and Beijing and why there's talk about that trade war having an effect on the global economy. Find us online at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, or our website, onpointradio.org, where Gregors writes, "My worry is the trade war with China escalating beyond that. If Xi's legitimacy gets seriously challenged, who knows how far he might go to restore it." We'll be back with more. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. Give the active people in your life something they'll truly appreciate. Performance apparel from Vuori. Whether they're into running, surfing, hiking, or even just casual walks around the block, there's something for everyone. And if you're not sure what to gift them, you can't go wrong with something from Vuori's Dream Knit collection. It's the perfect gift and so comfortable. Get 20% off your first purchase today at Vuori, Vuori.com/Spotify.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the Hong Kong protests and about that trade war between the U.S. and China and the effect that it's having and can have on the entire world's economy. I'm joined today by Robert Daly. He's with us from Washington. He's director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. David Rennie joins us from Beijing. He's Beijing Bureau Chief and Chaguan columnist for The Economist. And there's news still rolling in about the dispute between Washington and Beijing. For example, Goldman Sachs said just yesterday that fears of a U.S.-China trade war leading to a recession are increasing. Goldman no longer expects a trade deal between the world's two largest economies before the 2020 presidential election, and the company is saying that they expect tariffs targeting the remaining $300 billion of U.S. imports from China to go into effect. That's what Goldman Sachs said in a note to clients. So, David Rennie, let me just turn to you briefly. Why is it that many people are saying now, economists and observers of the global economy, that this trade war between the U.S. and China could potentially have extremely negative effects on the global economy?
The numbers are getting pretty big, and the uncertainty is getting very big. And in some ways, the uncertainty is the most damaging thing for a lot of businesses, because you can talk to business guys here in China who'll say, you know, we can live with, you know, a 10% tariff. We don't like it. But if we knew that was all it was going to be and it was never going to move, we could plan for that. But the fact that sometimes it's 10%, then it goes to 25%, and then it goes, you know, it's now going to spread potentially if President Trump carries through on his threat to extend tariffs to basically everything that China sells to the US, that's not just damaging because of the tariffs. The uncertainty then gets out of control, because one of the twists in this is that China has to date not retaliated dollar for dollar to the Trump tariffs. Part of that is a political calculation on the Chinese side. Part of it is almost mechanical, which is that because the US buys more from China than the other way around, they can't match the tariffs dollar for dollar because there just aren't the same level of imports to slap tariffs on. What does that mean? It means that if President Trump really goes for the full tariffs across the board, then China's going to have to start doing stuff that is sneakier in order to make America feel pain. It's going to have to do stuff bullying American companies. So if you run an American car company, do you suddenly get hit with a claim that your cars are polluting more than you said and you can't sell any more cars until that's sorted out? And everyone will understand that that's actually about the trade war. But in the meantime, you don't get to sell any cars. Or if you're a farmer, do your crops get seized at the port for a health inspection? I mean, the Chinese do this stuff all the time on a small scale. They do it on a big enough scale, and everyone's, you know, economic calculations are really thrown into absolute chaos.
Mm. Robert Daly, your thought on that?
Well, I think that that's exactly right. There's still a political issue on the American side, which David has already alluded to, which is how does President Trump look at the pain Americans must absorb as we get closer to the 2020 elections? If we see continued declines in the stock market, if, in fact, a recession should occur, does President Trump recalculate and accept the combination of Chinese purchases and promises that his predecessors were willing to accept? You know, China is absorbing some real pain because of the trade war. We see that in July, you know, credit is slowing down, productivity is lowering. At the same time, the Trump administration's claims that China's absorbing all the pain and is desperate for a trade deal are simply false. China's Foreign Affairs spokesman just pointed out that they're still growing about three times the rate of the United States. And we look, even since the trade war began about a year ago, Chinese exports to the United States with all the tariffs have actually increased. They're up about 1%, whereas our exports to China are down about 33%. This is not a story about the United States winning easily. In fact, the trade deficit with China, which was what the concern that launched all of this back during the presidential campaign, is actually increasing. So China, while it is deeply concerned both as an economic matter and also as a political matter, I think remains fairly confident that if this is a competition of privation and who can take it, that they have strength that the United States, which is, I think, broadly seen as being in decline in China, lacks, particularly as we head into 2020.
Mm. But Robert, if I may, just to be clear, I mean, this trade war is having some sort of impact on China, even if it's if it's proportionally less than it might be having here in the United States. But nevertheless, China being the world's second largest economy right now, a Chinese slowdown will have a spillover effect to the rest of the global economy, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. For the reasons that David has mentioned, and because really China has been an engine of global growth now for almost 40 years. So yes, the spillover effects, especially if we teeter over into a currency war, are very real. But vis-a-vis the United States, China still has certain advantages. President Xi doesn't face elections. There are no votes. There's no public opinion polling. The party controls all of the media. And because it's an authoritarian government with enormous foreign exchange reserves, it has mechanisms and ways of weathering increasing pain from the trade war that the United States does not have.
David, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, Robert raises a really interesting point, which is the prospect of a currency war. And that's one of the reasons I think that you can see markets getting spooked when the Americans had this very aggressive and, to be honest, not completely accurate response to the Chinese currency ticking over a psychological right. threshold late last week when the currency here went to 7 to the dollar, which is a kind of psychological line. And they were accused of currency manipulation. And actually, economists will tell you that that isn't quite right. But here's the thing about trade wars and currency wars. They can cause harm like real wars because of the damage that happens, because, you know, shells and bombs go off and things get damaged. But they can cause damage in another really important way, which is that if big giant economies like China and America start fighting a war that breaks the rules, the currency rules and the trade rules, that has really devastating concerns. I think it's really interesting if you talk to other governments, you know, in Europe or, you know, Japan, you know, big trade powers that aren't directly involved in this US-China confrontation, what frightens them is the idea that these two giant elephants, as they fight, could decide that actually they're not going to obey the usual rules about not having a kind of currency war where you devalue your currency on both sides to try and gain advantage, or they trample the international trade rules as they slap these tariffs on, whether they're legal or illegal tariffs. And that could actually do just as much damage to the global economy. And that's a real prospect, I think.
Mm. Well, let's go to Constantine, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Constantine, you're on the air.
Hi, Magnus. How are you? I love the show.
Thanks very much. What's your question, Constantine?
Well, it's a question and a comment. The Chinese government has been buying American debt in bonds for a long time. What happens if they decide to dump that?
Mm. Thanks so much for that question. Robert Daly, do you have a response for Constantine?
Yes, I think that this story is often misreported in the United States. If China decided to dump all of its debt, there are various ways that that might cause pain for the United States, but it would cause a tremendous amount of pain for China as well. If they wanted to dump about they hold about 7% of American sovereign debt. It's often reported in the States that China is our banker and that, you know, they hold all of the American debt instruments. This isn't true. China holds about 7%. They've been slowly ramping that down. If they dumped those instruments, their value would decrease and China would actually lose money. Furthermore, if they wanted to sell them, there would be buyers, including the United States government. It's not clear that that would actually be effective for China. It is clear that it would cost China in the immediate term, regardless of how it played out. So it's out there as a possibility, as is China's weaponizing their monopoly on the manufacture of rare earths. Would they stop exporting rare earths to the United States? That, too, would have costs for China. So, yes, there are other things that China could do, none of which are cost-free for Beijing.
Hmm. So, Robert, let me ask you, I think kind of at the center of the moment we find ourselves now is the question of what should be the basis, the fundamental basis of the relationship between the United States and China. Because as we were talking about earlier, there are people in Washington and even across the United States who see China as an existential threat to the United States. Others see it as a strategic threat. Flip the coin on the other side. I think President Xi himself has said, look, as China continues its rise, conflict with the United States is inevitable. So, I mean, is this just, are we going to have two powers at loggerheads here for quite some time?
I think that two powers at loggerheads for a long time is a much better way to put it than existential threat. This term is being thrown around in Washington far too loosely these days. An existential threat, a threat to our existence, means, you know, please pass the ammo and reload. China is a challenge, an issue. It is going to be with us as a geostrategic challenge for a number of decades. And while we will be at loggerheads because both nations seek global primacy geostrategically, economically, in terms of norms and practices, and especially with reference to technology. At the same time, both Beijing and Washington are determined not to go to war, the cost of which would be catastrophic. And there is fairly broad awareness in both nations of the need to cooperate in a number of spheres. So this is something that's unprecedented. This is the United States, which formerly regarded itself as the world's indispensable nation, now trying to deal with a peer competitor, the Middle Kingdom, which has a sense of superiority, which is exceptionalism, which is comparable to our own. Mm-hmm. So a new challenge, which I think if we had the wisdom and if we also work with multilateral partners, we could probably manage, but not without some conflict, not without some friction.
Yeah. So, David, you wrote about this a couple of months ago in The Economist. I'm looking at your article here, and you say China's rise was always going to cause turbulence. And, I mean, we have been seeing that for a while. And this is the continued turbulence we're seeing?
That's right. And one of the things I wrote about in that piece is that America, I mean, really the world has never seen this exact combination before. If you remember back to the 1980s when Japan's rise was the source of panic. Remember all those kind of Hollywood movies about, you know, sinister Japanese buying everything in sight and they're going to eat America's lunch. So that was an economic challenge. But remember, back then, Japan was not an ideological rival. In fact, politically, it basically was an ally that needed American, you know, military protection. So it was a purely economic threat. Back then, you had the Soviet Union was the ideological threat and, you know, the Cold War and all of that. But America hardly traded with the Soviet Union at all. When I wrote that piece, I ran the numbers. So in the 1980s, the U.S. did $2 billion of trade with the Soviet Union every year. At the moment, the U.S. does $2 billion of trade with China every day. So this is basically, to simplify, this is kind of the Japan competition challenge and the Soviet-style ideological threat rolled into one country. And America has never had to face that before.
So, Robert, then on that point, we also see, let me ask you, is China then looking beyond the United States as a primary trading partner or even rival? When China looks into the future, what does it see?
China, in the short term, is looking beyond the United States as a trading partner and finding new markets and also, you know, new sources of supply for its raw materials, for energy, for food, and it's diversifying its relationships in that way. Over the long term, China, especially under Xi Jinping, is trying to achieve what they call the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation and to build what, again, it calls its comprehensive national power, which is its word for the kind of superpower status, which includes military, economic, cultural, soft power status, that the United States has enjoyed. And China sees that kind of status, China's primacy, first in East Asia Pacific and then possibly internationally, as its destiny and in many ways its birthright. And if you look at China's history of past glory, it's incredible success of the past 40 years, its sheer size. It's easy to understand why the Chinese would feel that way and would reach for that now. That is not inherently nefarious, but certain China's interests, especially dominance in the Western Pacific, do run up against American interests, like maintaining our alliances with Japan and South Korea, like defending the global commons and international law, like promoting liberal practices worldwide. So we don't have to demonize China sort of in toto in everything it does to recognize that there is a clash of interests in many important spheres here. China sees itself, as in many ways, the Middle Kingdom and sees itself headed for that once again, as more than halfway there, in fact.
But Robert, let me ask you, and referencing David's piece here, really good in The Economist, David wrote that Beijing is missing how many people in Washington genuinely see China and the China threat as real, and that it matters more than politics or free market purity. That's David Rennie's writing there, and I know you don't see China as an existential threat, but do you see David's point though?
Absolutely, and this is still very much in play. The people who feel that way, and I would say that their numbers are growing, and I think that the median view, the consensus view in Washington, is far more hardline than it was before Xi Jinping came into power. But those concerns have not yet taken the form of a strategy. We've got a lot of attitude. We've got a lot of accusations, many of which have a strong basis in fact. China is our greatest long-term strategic challenge. But we haven't yet really defined that challenge, nor have we socialized it broadly and deeply as the threat from the Soviet Union. And even the fears about Japan in the 80s that David mentioned were broadly and deeply socialized in the past. So how do you explain to Americans outside of Washington what this threat that they don't feel in their daily lives is? How do you explain to them that they need to be willing to pay real costs over the long term to compete with China? That work of forming a real strategy and of bracing the American people, preparing them for this, has not been done. So we are still flailing at the strategic level.
Well, with that, we are flat out of time. So Robert Daly with us from Washington, director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief and Chaguan columnist for The Economist, with us via Skype from Beijing. David, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, we'll have links to the article that I referenced that David Rennie wrote in The Economist. That link will be at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.